was only the year or so later that he was to meet Tamara, Tamara, who till the very end was going to be his companion, his critic, his collaborator. Tamara was going to help him in the hours of tension and solitude. Meanwhile, the Polish government in exile sent the subversive corporal Deutscher to a disciplinary camp in Scotland. He was to emerge from there thanks to his pen. The future master of English prose was still struggling with the language, but his analytical power was sufficient to impress the editor of The Economist. His journalistic performance on The Economist, on The Observer, but also in Tribune, is public knowledge. One day, I hope, somebody will write about the wartime revolution in Fleet Street. What I want to mention here is that Deutscher remained true to himself. One illustration will be enough. He told me that during the war, his only difficulties on The Observer were connected with his criticism of the Soviet Union. Because of the struggle of the Russian people, he was not going to forget, say, concentration camps, quite the contrary. A few years later came the Cold War, and often the very same people attacked Deutscher as an apologist for Russia. From journalism, he turned to writing books. The choice of biography was, in a sense, accidental. What mattered was to reach a fairly wide public with his message about Russia. It mattered to him as a socialist to give a balanced view of the first workers' state. It was important to remind people that the nationalization of the means of production was necessary, but not a sufficient condition for establishing socialism. It was important to treat the Soviet Union as a species of its own, a post-capitalist society, since this was the only way in which Marxist tools of analysis could be applied to its performance. It was vital in the Manichaean days of the Cold War that somebody should rise above the caricatures of workers' paradise or land of slaves. How important it was, we got some idea in the period of disillusionment following Khrushchev's superficial indictment. Others will tell you how Deutscher, the historian, accomplished this indispensable task. I just want to mention two points the books show about their own. The first, once again, is his respect for truth in all its complexity. It would have been easy to describe Svetlana's beloved father as just Cain Djugashvili, the grave digger of the revolution. For a man with Deutscher's background, it required much greater effort to describe him in Marxist terms as the product of primitive socialist accumulation. Similarly, Trotsky had Deutscher's full sympathy and admiration, but he did not write about him like a socialist realist about Stalin or a Catholic about the Pope. He showed his greatness and his tragedy in the gap between theory and practice, and his hero's superhuman effort to close that gap. The second point the books show is Deutscher's basic optimism. Look once again at the monumental trilogy with its beautiful balanced sentences reflecting a balanced analysis. In its subtle construction, the final chapter, Victory in Defeat, echoes the earlier Defeat in Victory. True, like his hero, Deutscher would have stood on the side of the wretched even if their struggle had been hopeless. But he did not think that it was hopeless. Oh, he had no magic formula, knew neither magic shortcut nor secret timetable. His faith rested on his belief in man, who ultimately would choose socialism rather than madness and suicide. He kept this deep conviction throughout the terrible period he lived through. He kept it in years of despair when the best revolutionaries were to be found in Stalin's concentration camps, in years of contempt when Nazi order reigned over Europe, in years of disenchantment when the West seemed to have entirely forgotten its socialist heritage. It could be then said of him what he wrote of Trotsky. Never had any man lived in so close communion with the sufferings and the strivings of oppressed humanity and in such utter loneliness. But he lived long enough to see brighter lights on the horizon, to hear his message echoing around the world. I am convinced that Deutscher's life, like his work, has a universal meaning. What was so exceptional in this life beyond his extraordinary talents and character? True, he turned to socialism not because of the consciousness of his class interest. Yet this can be said about every intellectual joining the socialist movement. True, he was born in a Jewish community that has vanished. But Jews, after all, have just given a proof that they are no more immune to nationalism than anybody else. At the same time, Deutscher was confirming in an interview the internationalism that was inseparable from his socialism. Genuinely, anything nationalist was alien to him. There is no dividing line between his Polish or his English values. There is continuity between the young man impatient to change the world and the member of the Russell Tribunal or the author of Unfinished Revolution. This is why his example is valid for us too. On this occasion, we are painfully aware that man is mortal, but this is no reason for him to become a plaything of fate. For us, for whom there is no God, no Caesar, and no personal solution, Deutscher has shown the only way to dignity by struggling whatever the odds to change the world, by fighting for the socialist transformation of mankind. Isaac Deutscher is no longer with us. What this must mean to Tamara, his companion, I can guess, judging by the emptiness I feel myself. He was so young. Age is not just a question of years. If by youth we mean the refusal to submit, to surrender, to yield, then Deutscher was the youngest of us all. And he had so many plans, so many projects, so much still to accomplish. But what we must remember is what he had achieved in his lifetime. He was fond of saying that Russians one day will be his most voracious readers. And certainly that day will come when in his books they will discover their past history, a knowledge without which they cannot properly build their future. But already now, elsewhere, his analysis of Soviet society helps socialists to consolidate their faith. Cuban revolutionaries and unorthodox Italian communists, American fighters against war in Vietnam and Japanese students, the new left throughout the world finds encouragement and inspiration in his work. His life, like his work, is an example. There is no socialist man, because as yet there is no socialist society. When one will emerge, it will be too rational to erect tombs in its red square. Men who have helped mankind to reach this socialist future will be celebrated in history books and in the memory of future generations. I cannot pay a greater tribute to Isaac Deutscher than to claim that, seemingly born in the wrong time and in the wrong place, he will figure prominently next to Trotsky in such a revolutionary pantheon.
The next speaker upon whom I should like to call is David Horowitz, who perhaps exemplifies as well as anybody can the close links which came to be established in the last years of his life between Isaac Deutscher and that new rising generation of intellectuals and socialists in whom we place so much confidence. David Horowitz.
At this painful time, when the memory of the man himself is still vivid in our minds, those of us who knew Isaac Deutscher have a duty to bear witness to the life and to the work. In him, the tragedy of human death, the irrevocable loss of a being utterly unique and irreplaceable, is magnified to such dimensions that it is understood by tens of thousands who knew him only through his books. How much more then is it to us, to whom he was a teacher and a friend? Tonight, however, I should like to speak about him in personal terms, only as they reflect upon the public life, upon his place and role in the revolutionary movement, in which he will be seen by future generations to have been a most vital figure. For with Deutscher, the revolutionary deed was the word. What I remember most about Isaac Deutscher was the sense I always had in his presence of listening to a voice from a wholly different and incredibly cultured world. His conversation was rich with the reminiscence of names and places which I did not know. And even when familiar, they were spoken of within a framework which is fascinatingly remote. I felt with Deutscher as though through him I were contacting a living past and touching deep down into the wellsprings of European culture, of revolutionary culture, and the still vibrant outlook of the classical Bolshevik era. I believe that when Deutscher listened to me and to others of my generation, he also had the experience of communicating across an immense chasm of culture and historical time, and that while we searched his phrases and sentences for roots, he peered into ours seeking response. Exactly what response he sought can only be guessed. But I remember the light which flooded his face when he returned from his trip to Berkeley and Washington, and the thrill with which he spoke of the great Vietnam protests to which he had been invited by the American New Left. It was this New Left to which Deutscher looked, and I know that much of the precious time that he lavished all too prodigally on me and others like me was a token of the faith and hope that he placed in our generation. Nor was it an accident that the terrible isolation from the left which Deutscher experienced during most of the post-war years was broken finally only by this new generation. Deutscher, the biographer of Stalin and Trotsky, left no autobiographical statement. Yet in fragments of his work, which like all art contain a large element of introspection, we can see reflected the essential features of his own life and can begin to understand his relation to the old revolutionary left and the new. 10 years ago, Deutscher gave a lecture under the title The Message of the Non-Jewish Jew, in which he discussed six Jewish heretics, including Spinoza, Marx, Rosa Luxemburg, and Trotsky. As Deutscher often used a literary image to bind up complex theoretical themes in his larger works, so he began this lecture with a symbolic story. When still a child, he had come across a scene in the Midrash from the narrative of Rabbi Meir, the great pillar of Mosaic Orthodoxy, who took lessons in theology from a heretic bearing the nickname Acher, the stranger. Once on a Sabbath, Rabbi Meir had gone out on a trip with his teacher and had listened so intently to the words of wisdom falling from heretical lips that he failed to notice that they had reached the ritual boundary, which Jews were not allowed to cross on the Sabbath. At this point, the great heretic indicated to his pupil, the rabbi, that they had reached the boundary, whereupon the rabbi went back to the Jewish community while the heretic rode on beyond the boundaries of Jewry. The young Deutscher was deeply impressed by the figure of Acher and the enigmas which his story posed to an Orthodox viewpoint. Why, the boy wondered, did Rabbi Meir take his lessons from the heretic? Who was he? He appeared to be in Jewry and yet out of it. He showed a curious respect for his pupil's orthodoxy when he sent him back to the Jews on the Holy Sabbath, but he himself, disregarding canon and ritual, rode beyond the boundaries. What made him transcend Judaism? These were the questions that agitated the young Deutscher. In retrospect, it is hardly surprising that the biographer of the heretic Trotsky should, in the middle 50s, more than a third of a century later, still be compelled by the Haggadic tale. Indeed, how well the figure of Acher fits Deutscher himself. For was not Deutscher also the heretic of communism? The heretic who, in the post-Stalin decade, became a teacher, mainly to rank-and-file communists, but also to not a few rabbis of communism as well.